Chapter 5. Create a need. Stir anxiety and discontent. A perfectly satisfied person cannot be seduced. Tension and disharmony must be instilled in your target's minds. Stir within them feelings of discontent and unhappiness with their circumstances and with themselves. Their life lacks adventure. They have strayed from the ideals of their youth. They have become boring. The feelings of inadequacy that you create will give you space to insinuate yourself, to make them see you as the answer to their problems. Pain and anxiety are the proper precursors to pleasure. Learn to manufacture the need that you can fill. Opening a wound. In the coal mining town of Eastwood in central England, David Herbert Lawrence was considered something of a strange lad. Pale and delicate, he had no time for games or boyish pursuits, but was interested in literature, and he preferred the company of girls, who made up most of his friends. Lawrence often visited the Chambers family, who had been his neighbors until they moved out of Eastwood to a farm not far away. He liked to study with the Chambers sisters, particularly Jessie. She was shy and serious, and getting her to open up and confide in him was a pleasurable challenge. Jessie grew quite attached to Lawrence over the years, and they became good friends. One day, in 1906, Lawrence, 21 at the time, did not show up at the usual hour for his study session with Jessie. He finally arrived much later, in a mood she had never seen before, preoccupied and quiet. Now it was her turn to make him open up. Finally, he talked. He felt she was getting too close to him. What about her future? Whom would she marry? Certainly not him, he said, for they were just friends. But it was unfair of him to keep her from seeing others. They should, of course, remain friends and have their talks, but maybe less often. When he finished and left, she felt a strange emptiness. She had yet to think much about love or marriage. Suddenly, she had doubts. What would her future be? Why wasn't she thinking about it? She felt anxious and upset, without understanding why. Lawrence continued to visit, but everything had changed. He criticized her for this and that. She wasn't very physical. What kind of wife would she make anyway? A man needed more from a woman than just talk. He likened her to a nun. They began to see each other less often. When, sometime later, Lawrence accepted a teaching position at a school outside London, she felt part relieved to be rid of him for a while. But when he said goodbye to her, and intimated that it might be for the last time, she broke down and cried. Then he started sending her weekly letters. He would write about girls he was seeing, maybe one of them would be his wife. Finally, at his behest, she visited him in London. They got along well, as in the old times, but he continued to badger her about her future, picking at that old wound. At Christmas, he was back in Eastwood, and when he visited her, he seemed exultant. He had decided that it was Jessie he should marry, that he had, in fact, been attracted to her all along. They should keep it quiet for a while, although his writing career was taking off. His first novel was about to be published. He needed to make more money. Caught off guard by this sudden announcement and overwhelmed with happiness, Jessie agreed to everything, and they became lovers. Soon, however, the familiar pattern repeated. Criticisms, breakups, announcements that he was engaged to another girl. This only deepened his hold on her. It was not until 1912 that she finally decided never to see him again, disturbed by his portrayal of her in the autobiographical novel Sons and Lovers. But Lawrence remained a lifelong obsession for her. In 1913, a young Englishwoman named Ivy Lowe, who had read Lawrence's novels, began to correspond with him, her letters gushing with admiration. By now, Lawrence was married to a German woman, the Baroness Frieda von Richthofen. To Lowe's surprise, though, he invited her to visit him and his wife in Italy. She knew he was probably something of a Don Juan, but was eager to meet him and accepted his invitation. Lawrence was not what she had expected. His voice was high-pitched, his eyes were piercing, and there was something vaguely feminine about him. Soon they were taking walks together, with Lawrence confiding in Lo. She felt that they were becoming friends, which delighted her. Then suddenly, just before she was to leave, he launched into a series of criticisms of her. She was so unspontaneous, so predictable, less human being than robot. Devastated by this unexpected attack, she nevertheless had to agree what he had said was true. What could he have seen in her in the first place? Who was she, anyway? Lo left Italy feeling empty, but then Lawrence continued to write to her as if nothing had happened. She soon realized that she had fallen hopelessly in love with him, despite everything he had said to her. Or was it not despite what he had said, but because of it? In 1914, the writer John Middleton Murray received a letter from Lawrence, a good friend of his. In the letter, out of nowhere, Lawrence criticized Middleton Murray for being passionless and not gallant enough with his wife, the novelist Catherine Mansfield. Middleton Murray later wrote, quote, "I had never felt for a man before what his letter made me feel for him. It was a new thing, a unique thing in my experience, and it was to remain unique," unquote. He felt that beneath Lawrence's criticisms lay some weird kind of affection. Whatever he saw Lawrence from then on, he felt a strange physical attraction that he could not explain. Interpretation. The number of women and of men who fell under Lawrence's spell is astonishing, given how unpleasant he could be. In almost every case, the relationship began in friendship with frank talks, exchanges of confidences, a spiritual bond. Then, invariably, he would suddenly turn against them, voicing harsh personal criticisms. He would know them well by that time, and the criticisms were often quite accurate and hit a nerve. This would inevitably trigger confusion in his victims and a sense of anxiety, a feeling that something was wrong with them. Jolted out of their usual sense of normality, they would feel divided inside. With half of their minds, they wondered why he was doing this and felt he was unfair. With the other half, they believed it was all true. Then, in those moments of self-doubt, they would get a letter or a visit from him, in which he was his old charming self. Now they saw him differently. Now they were weak and vulnerable, in need of something, and he would seem so strong. Now he drew them to him, feelings of friendship turning into affection and desire. Once they felt uncertain about themselves, they were susceptible to falling in love. Most of us protect ourselves from the harshness of life by succumbing to routines and patterns, by closing ourselves off from others. But underlying these habits is a tremendous sense of insecurity and defensiveness. We feel we are not really living. The seducer must pick at this wound and bring these semi-conscious thoughts into full awareness. This was what Lawrence did. His sudden, brutally unexpected jabs would hit people at their weak spot. Although Lawrence had great success with his frontal approach, it's often better to stir thoughts of inadequacy and uncertainty indirectly, by hinting at comparisons to yourself or to others, and by insinuating somehow that your victims' lives are less grand than they had imagined. You want them to feel at war with themselves, torn in two directions, and anxious about it. Anxiety, a feeling of lack and need, is the precursor of all desire. These jolts in the victim's mind create space for you to insinuate your poison, the siren call of adventure or fulfillment that will make them follow you into your web. Without anxiety and a sense of lack, there can be no seduction. Keys to seduction. Everyone wears a mask in society. We pretend to be more sure of ourselves than we are. We don't want other people to glimpse that doubting self within us. In truth, our egos and personalities are much more fragile than they appear to be. They cover up feelings of confusion and emptiness. As a seducer, you must never mistake a person's appearance for the reality. People are always susceptible to being seduced because, in fact, everyone lacks a sense of completeness, feels something missing deep inside. Bring their doubts and anxieties to the surface, and they can be led and lured to follow you. No one can see you as someone to follow or fall in love with unless they first reflect on themselves somehow and on what they're missing. Before the seduction proceeds, you must place a mirror in front of them in which they glimpse that inner emptiness. Made aware of a lack, they now can focus on you as the person who can fill that empty space. Remember, most of us are lazy. To relieve our feelings of boredom or inadequacy on our own takes too much effort. Letting someone else do the job is both easier and more exciting. The desire to have someone fill up our emptiness is the weakness on which all seducers prey. Make people anxious about the future. Make them depressed. Make them question their identity. Make them sense the boredom that gnaws at their life. The ground is prepared. The seeds of seduction can be sown. In Plato's dialogue Symposium, the West's oldest treatise on love, and a text that has had a determining influence on our ideas of desire, the courtesan Diotima explains to Socrates the parentage of Eros, the god of love. Eros's father was contrivance, or cunning, and his mother was poverty, or need. Eros takes after his parents. He is constantly in need, which he is constantly contriving to fill. As the god of love, he knows that love cannot be induced in another person unless they too feel need. And that is what his arrows do. Piercing people's flesh, they make them feel a lack, an ache, a hunger. This is the essence of your task as a seducer. Like Eros, you must create a wound in your victim, aiming at their soft spot, the chink in their self-esteem. If they're stuck in a rut, make them feel it more deeply, innocently bringing it up and talking about it. What you want is a wound, an insecurity you can expand a little, an anxiety that can best be relieved by involvement with another person, namely you. They must feel the wound before they fall in love. Notice how Lawrence stirred anxiety, always hitting at his victim's weak spot. For Jessie Chambers, her physical coldness. For Ivy Lowe, her lack of spontaneity. For Middleton Murray, his lack of gallantry. Cleopatra got Julius Caesar to sleep with her the first night he met her. But the real seduction, the one that made him her slave, began later. In their ensuing conversations, she talked repeatedly of Alexander the Great, the hero from whom she was supposedly descended. No one could compare to him. By implication, Caesar was made to feel inferior. Understanding that beneath his bravado, Caesar was insecure, Cleopatra awakened in him an anxiety, a hunger to prove his greatness. Once he felt this way, he was easily further seduced. Doubts about his masculinity was his tender spot. When Caesar was assassinated, Cleopatra turned her sights on Mark Antony, one of Caesar's successors in the leadership of Rome. Antony loved pleasure and spectacle, and his tastes were crude. She appeared to him first on her royal barge, then wined and dined and banqueted him. Everything was geared to suggest to him the superiority of the Egyptian way of life over the Roman, at least when it came to pleasure. The Romans were boring and unsophisticated by comparison, and once Antony was made to feel how much he was missing in spending his time with his dull soldiers and his matronly Roman wife, he could be made to see Cleopatra as the incarnation of all that was exciting. He became her slave. This is the lure of the exotic. In your role of seducer, try to position yourself as coming from the outside, as a stranger of sorts. You represent change, difference, a breakup of routines. Make your victims feel that, by comparison, their lives are boring and their friends less interesting than they had thought. Lawrence made his targets feel personally inadequate. If you find it hard to be so brutal, concentrate on their friends, their circumstances, the externals of their lives. There are many legends of Don Juan, but they often describe him seducing a village girl by making her feel that her life is horribly provincial. He, meanwhile, wears glittering clothes and has a noble bearing. Strange and exotic, he's always from somewhere else. First, she feels the boredom of her life, then she sees him as her salvation. Remember, people prefer to feel that if their life is uninteresting, it's not because of themselves, but because of their circumstances. The dull people they know, the town into which they were born. Once you make them feel the lure of the exotic, seduction is easy. Another devilishly seductive area to aim at is the victim's past. To grow old is to renounce or compromise youthful ideals, to become less spontaneous, less alive, in a way. This knowledge lies dormant in all of us. As a seducer, you must bring it to the surface, make it clear how far people have strayed from their past goals and ideals. You, in turn, present yourself as representing that ideal, as offering a chance to recapture lost youth through adventure, through seduction. In her later years, Queen Elizabeth I of England was known as a rather stern and demanding ruler. She made it a point not to let her courtiers see anything soft or weak in her. But then Robert Devereux, the second Earl of Essex, came to court. Much younger than the Queen, the dashing Essex would often chastise her for her sourness. The Queen would forgive him. He was so exuberant and spontaneous, he could not control himself. But his comments got under her skin. In the presence of Essex, she came to remember all the youthful ideals, spiritedness, feminine charm, that had since vanished from her life. She also felt a little of that girlish spirit return when she was around him. He quickly became her favorite, and soon she was in love with him. Old age is constantly seduced by youth, but first, the young people must make it clear what the older ones are missing. How they have lost their ideals. Only then will they feel that the presence of the young will let them recapture that spark, the rebellious spirit that age and society have conspired to repress. This concept has infinite applications. Corporations and politicians know that they cannot seduce their public into buying what they want them to buy or doing what they want them to do unless they first awaken a sense of need and discontent. Make the masses uncertain about their identity, and you can help define it for them. It is as true of groups or nations as it is of individuals. They cannot be seduced without being made to feel some lack. Part of John F. Kennedy's election strategy in 1960 was to make Americans unhappy about the 1950s and how far the country had strayed from its ideals. In talking about the 1950s, he didn't mention the nation's economic stability or its emergence as a superpower. Instead, he implied that the period was marked by conformity, a lack of risk and adventure, a loss of our frontier values. To vote for Kennedy was to embark on a collective adventure, to go back to ideals we had given up. But before anyone joined his crusade, they had to be made aware of how much they had lost, what was missing. A group like an individual, can get mired in routine, losing track of its original goals. Too much prosperity saps it of strength. You can seduce an entire nation by aiming at its collective insecurity, that latent sense that not everything is what it seems. Stirring dissatisfaction with the present and reminding people about the glorious past can unsettle their sense of identity. Then you can be the one to redefine it. A grand seduction. Reversal. If you go too far in lowering the target's self-esteem, they may feel too insecure to enter into your seduction. Do not be heavy-handed. Like Lawrence, always follow up the wounding attack with a soothing gesture. Otherwise, you will simply alienate them. Charm is often a subtler and more effective route to seduction. The Victorian Prime Minister, Benjamin Disraeli, always made people feel better about themselves. He deferred to them, made them the center of attention, made them feel witty and vibrant. He was a boon to their vanity, and they grew addicted to him. This is a kind of diffused seduction, lacking intention and in the deep emotions that the sexual variety stirs. It bypasses people's hunger, their need for some kind of fulfillment. But if you're subtle and clever, it can be a way of lowering their defenses, creating an unthreatening friendship. Once they are under your spell in this way, you can then open the wound. Indeed, after Disraeli had charmed Queen Victoria and established a friendship with her, he made her feel vaguely inadequate in the establishment of an empire and the realization of her ideals. Everything depends on the target. People who are riddled with insecurities may require the gentler variety. Once they feel comfortable with you, aim your arrows.